Hello, you're very welcome to the Alison Spittle Show. My name is Alison Spittle. I might sound a bit different because once again I'm in a professional environment doing a professional recording and not recording this in my toilet on my mobile phone, which I normally do for my intros and outros. Today we have Sinead Burke. Sinead Burke is a fashionista that's been to London. That doesn't sound that impressive, but but Washington. She's been to the White House, you guys. And she just genuinely, I've seen her do speeches. Anytime I've met her, I've been impressed by her. And I can't wait for you to hear the interview. So let's hear it right now. See, I can't wait. I can't wait that I'm right now. Bang. This is the So, Sinead, thank you so much for agreeing to be on my podcast.
I am delighted to be here. Thank you for having me, Alison Spittle. That's lovely Baptist talk.
Are you watching Celebrity Big Brother at the moment?
I'm not, but I've heard that Jetford are doing very well, which I'm very pleased about.
Yeah, they're so good.
I really like them. There's a lot of heart to them. But I'm not watching them, but apparently they did something to Callum Best and they made his True Colours show. This is what I read on glimpses of 140 characters on Twitter.
Oh, really?
So I am not entirely sure what's going on, but I do believe that Jedward are doing quite well, which I'm pleased about.
They are, I'm proud. They're doing our country very well.
Good men.
So you were in Washington a little while back.
I was.
What was Washington like? What's the shopping like?
I didn't get to do much shopping. So the invitation, so I was there for a visit to the White House. There was an event taking place in the White House called Design for All, which is a fusion of kind of fashion and disability. And I was there because I'm the co-founder of an organization called the Inclusive Fashion and Design Collective. And we are a consultancy which aims to amplify the disabled and minority voices within the archaic institution of the fashion industry. And we were, myself and my co-founder Liz, I was going to New York to launch the IFTC. And instead, we got an opportunity from the White House to launch in Washington instead. An opportunity that you can't really say no to.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was very surreal. And the invitation came into my inbox, you know.
It was in an email, wasn't
it? In an email, and I thought it was spam. Because I had never received an email of that type before from like a government email address or anything like that in the US.
Yeah, because if you get a letter from the government, you expect a good quality of paper.
Well, that's it. Or you expect that you're in trouble for some sorts. And I kind of thought...
there's like a wax seal on the back.
Exactly. And I thought that was like maybe a phishing email or something and my passport details or whatever it was. So I just didn't reply. And then about 24 hours passed and my co-founder Liz emailed me and was like, can I just ask a question? Why have you not replied to the White House? And I was like, oh, right. I'll do that right away. I'll get onto that straight away. And yeah, it was lovely. For me, it was my first time to travel on my own.
Right.
So I flew from Dublin to New York. And then myself and Liz had a bit of work to do in New York. We attended the Rhode Island School of Design, their fashion show. And then we got the train to Washington.
Oh my gosh.
And then we got into Washington about 1 a.m. And we had about 4 or 5 hours sleep. And we went straight to the White House. So the event took place at 10 a.m. in the White House. But you have to be there quite a few hours early for security clearance.
Tell me about that.
Very like intense, and you know, you give them your passport and you have to be on the list prior to, even though all of those details are confirmed and that, and they just kind of check everything, and it's just it's very structured and very kind of intense. And I suppose, you know, not that we have a brilliant kind of judicial system and everything here in Ireland, but there's just it just feels much more intense when you're there. And eventually got through the security system, wore a tag around my neck that said A for alien, I believe. So you have to be escorted around the building if you're not an American citizen, which is what the case was at the time. And it was just lovely. And I think for me, as somebody who's had an interest in fashion since childhood, particularly because it stemmed out of not feeling part of the conversation, not feeling represented and not feeling welcome, to see something like the Obama administration, particularly in their final days, say that this is something that's important, that this is something they believe in. When, you know, you talk to people about fashion and the value of fashion and they think it's quite a facetious industry, and to see them realising the potential of it, particularly for people with disabilities or minority voices, was amazing. And, you know, we spoke on a panel and there was a lots of brilliant people, like the head of innovation for Nike was there, you know, representatives from IMG, the modeling agency, were there. There was a fashion show with people like Jillian Mercado, who is this amazing model, and happens to be a wheelchair user and was the face of Beyonce's campaign last year.
Oh, so wow.
There was all of these really interesting people, and then Claudia L. Gordon, who was the first black and hearing impaired, black and deaf lawyer ever to exist kind of within the US.
Wow.
And she was there, and she's obviously was an advisor to Barack Obama. And there's all of these like just really interesting people who were in the room. And yeah, so I spent about 6 hours in Washington, got straight back on a train to New York, got into Penn Station in New York, got straight into a cab back to JFK Airport, and flew out and went to London Fashion Week for about 8 hours, went to the Paul Costello show in London, and flew straight home that night. And yeah, that all happened in like 3 days.
That's
so I
incredible.
Came home and people were like, how was the White House? And I was like, no, but you don't understand. I did it all on my own. Let's talk about that. And they were like, no.
So what was it like traveling on your own? Because that sounds like...
Yeah, for me...
you talk about your face lights up more.
I think it's that kind of... You know, I'm the eldest of five children, and I know you are the same, Alison. And I think I've had this kind of pseudo-independence or pseudo kind of older sibling role.
Yeah.
In the sense that even though, as regards to my age, I'm the eldest sibling, because I stand at the height of 3'5" tall, I'm a little person. A lot of the roles which are typically given to, say, the elder sibling, physically was a little bit more difficult for me. Don't get me wrong, I totally played on that in my youth and in my teenage years.
Yes.
Oh, can you do that? Shane? No, I can't. I can't do that.
How many years were between you and the second oldest?
Oh, 2 years.
Oh, right, cool.
So there's only 8 years between all five of us.
Right.
The gap is very, very small. And I think, yeah, I was really proud of myself that I managed to do that. But it wasn't entirely on my own. There's a support system in Dublin Airport and internationally called OCS, which is given to, you know, passengers with disabilities. So I have a wheelchair through most of the airport, and mostly that's because of security. So the security desk, you know, where you put your luggage on, is really high. And I think there's legal implications as regards to those who work in security. They can't lift my bag from the ground up in case there's anything in my bag, which totally makes sense.
But physically,
I don't have the strength to lift it over my head. So you're kind of at this impasse with security going, hi, we both need to get past this stage and process. So OCS, in regards to kind of the services that they do, and, you know, it was brilliant to fly Aer Lingus, and staff in Aer Lingus are so helpful in that they will put the luggage overhead for you without even having to ask. So little things like that really helped. But yeah, I was just chuffed to myself that I came back and survived and didn't get lost somewhere in the middle of New York City or in Washington and did it all on my own. And yeah, it was very surreal. I think 16-year-old me probably wouldn't believe that that happened in a weird way.
And what was, out of New York, Washington and London, what was the most friendly towards you and your, I was going to say disability, is if you have a disability. Not that it's not, chicken, I'm just going to be weird about talking
please
about
do.
This. You
please
know
do.
I mean?
Throw the language at me. Let's have a frank discussion. No, it's interesting because people would say to me, you know, you're not disabled.
Because I feel like, this sounds stupid, but I feel like I'd be offending you if I said you're disabled.
And I think that's an interesting point because as a society, we need to look at why we consider it to be offensive to have a disability.
Exactly.
So is it because we see people with disabilities as less, or we see disability as less as a society? And I think we need to look at that and say, well, why is that? So I would definitely say that I am disabled. I am physically disabled.
Yeah.
And I think...
Because you can't use a security
I'm disabled by the environment because when the environment was put in place, I was never thought about in the design or in the implication. In many ways, then, as regards to society disables me in some ways as regards to people's perceptions of me based on stereotypes, characteristics, or whatever it is. They make assumptions about what I can or more than likely what I can't do. So I would definitely use the label that I am disabled. I would say that I'm a disabled feminist, and those are two things that I'm very proud of.
I think
as somebody who is disabled, I have characteristics and traits because of my disability that others don't. So I would be innately organized and creative in some ways.
Yeah.
My bedroom is a mess. But we won't dwell on that fact. But because I have to be. So like coming here to the studio today, I had to know exactly where it was that I was going.
Yeah.
I had to be able to map out my journey. I had to know, gosh, will I be able to reach the buzzer on the door? If not, do I stop somebody who works in the shop next door? Do I stop somebody on the street? Do I bring a bottle of Coke or my phone with me so that I have an extra 6 inches in my reach?
Yeah.
Or is there something around that I can turn upside down? And that kind of thinking is part of my normality. Whereas if anybody else went into that situation, would those be the immediate ideas that come to mind? And possibly not. Just because that's the way in which
it's
I live my life.
It's not part of my normal life.
Yeah.
So even when, because we have like two two stories of stairs up here. And before you came, I was like, shit, Sinead. And then I was thinking, what am I going to do? Am I going to offer her help? I think it stems because my dad was disabled for a few years. He was in a wheelchair and he didn't take it very well.
Yeah.
So I've always kind of seen disability as from a person that did not. He's out of it now.
Yeah.
But he was like naturally he was very angry of over course. It and over his circumstances. And I think he never wanted it. Like even though he was in a wheelchair and he worked in the buildings, he would. Like in Mullingar, he didn't want to accept that he couldn't work on a building site. So he would have to build walls that were of a certain height.
Of course.
And they'd let him do that.
Yeah.
But, and that would be, I think that was more to make him feel like his life wasn't changed that much.
Yeah.
And I think I've always kind of avoided talking to him about it or looking at that as a normality.
Yeah.
So I find it weird to. Because I think I've definitely been coloured by that. So when I meet people that are disabled, I just go, shit, how can I, do they want me to ignore? It's so difficult and stupid.
And for me, I think, you know, the experience of disabled people, they're so varied and they're so different, you know, so one of my biggest difficulties is public toilets. Because when I go into, say, the regular bathroom, I can't reach the lock on the cubicle door. I can't reach the sink. I can't reach the soap dispenser. I can't reach the mirror or the hand dryer. But I can use the toilet, the physical toilet.
Yeah. Or and even the toilet roll dispensers are ridiculous. Yeah.
Or sometimes they put them, like, at the back of the toilet, which makes no sense to me in terms of design.
Yeah.
And then I go into the disabled or the accessible bathroom and I can reach the sink. I can sometimes reach in the mirror, depending on where they put the soap dispenser and the hand dryer. But I can't reach the physical toilet because it is an additional, say, 4 to 6 inches higher so that those who use wheelchairs can transfer across. And that makes absolute sense as regards to the needs of that group of people, but it doesn't suit me. But, you know, I suppose the breadth of types of disability and needs for the disabled community is so wide and all-encompassing. How do you include everybody in the conversation?
Yeah.
So I think everybody, I think that willingness to kind of even have this conversation and say, well, you know, do you categorize yourself in that way? And what do you do? And I think that's really helpful in just being brave and saying, I have a question. I may not always answer your question, Alison.
No, you shouldn't feel that you have to. That's exactly it.
Like,
I don't want you to be my, hello.
Yeah.
I am an ignorant, able-bodied, not even, do you know what I mean?
But that's it. There's this brilliant TED Talk by a woman called Stella Young.
And I felt weird to qualify it by going, my dad was disabled.
Yeah.
Do you know?
But there's this brilliant TED Talk by a woman called Stella Young, and she talks about this whole idea of inspiration porn, which is often tied to the disabled community. And this whole idea that particularly plays out in the media, that disabled people's sole function in life is to be a vehicle for inspiration or a vehicle for learning to the able-bodied community. And that happens when you read things, whether it's about the Paralympics and all of these different initiatives. And the Paralympics is an amazing initiative. Yes, or you read things for clicks and for likes, you know, things that, gosh, now if that disabled person can do that, can you imagine what you could do?
Yeah.
And I'm like, thanks a million, but like, I'm grand.
It's not a compliment either.
No, it's absolutely not a compliment. So she calls it inspiration porn.
Right.
And I would
like
love
when people come up to me and they go, you have a beautiful face.
Yeah.
You could be so attractive.
You could be a hand model. And you're like, thanks a million. Don't talk to me ever again.
But it's so odd that humans think they're coming from such a good place. I suppose because we got access to social media and the people do keep trying to inspire each other.
It's bizarre.
It's so bizarre.
I got onto a bus the other day and I was kind of standing in the disabled area of the bus. And I had my back to kind of the rest of the seats. And this person who was sitting in the row behind me taps me on the head and loudly declares to the bus, are you okay? Where is your mommy? I was like, oh no.
Why would you tap a child on the head? Even
I was like, what do I do here in this situation? Because regardless of what I do, she's going to be embarrassed.
So I
kind of turned around, like waved, looked her in the eye and went, I'm okay, thanks. And she went, oh. And it was left at that. And I got off at the next job. And I was texting a really good friend. And I was like, oh my God, this just happened to me. And she very kind of carefully and considered phrased a question. Was like, what were you wearing? Like, did you look like a child today? And I was like, no, I wore a full-length faux fur leopard print coat.
You
and I had a bag that was, you know, most of the size of me that was by, you know, a fashion designer or whatever it was. And I was like, I don't think a 10-year-old would be outfitted in this, particularly on their own. So you're trying to kind of balance that. And at the same time, being conscious that it's not my responsibility not to make others feel better about my difference and stuff. So, yeah, it's a bizarre kind of, you teeter along all of those boundaries a lot.
And when did you start feeling like that about, like, that? I'm sure at some point you must have felt like your responsibility was to make people feel, did that ever come into
my
the equation?
My dad is a little person. And everybody.
Your dad looks very like my dad.
Oh, really?
He does.
This is good to know. He's not
same hairline, and he's English.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, he's English. What England is he from?
My dad's. Well, he was born in Birmingham, but he's.
So
brought
is my
up
dad.
Really?
Oh my God, we could be sisters
could
four
be
times
sisters.
Removed.
I have to show you a picture of my dad.
God.
He's got
we'll
the exact
have to find
same
out
hairline.
Off air where in Birmingham your dad is from. We could be distant cousins, Alison.
We could.
That's mad.
Yeah. That's mad. But I suppose I'm going to go back to fashion because do you know what? I don't want the whole podcast to be about this either.
Perfect.
This because I got into one line and then you talk about it loads because there's loads to talk about, but I don't want this
I waffle
to be
on.
No, it's good that you do. It's
go on, hit me with the fashion question.
Yeah, like when did you start getting into fashion?
I think I was in my sister's house who lives down the country over the weekend.
And I just want to say, it's interesting how your friend asked you, like, if you were dressed like a child.
Well,
that you have to take that into consideration.
Oh, absolutely, because that's the kind of clothes that I straddle the boundary of children's wear and women's wear.
Yeah.
And my friend,
I would
is
love,
the most amazing
I'm sorry,
person.
This sounds like, no, really, no. I would love to straddle the boundary.
Yeah.
Some of the children's, and that sounds like
some
such an arsehole.
Some of it is,
thing.
Though we do have to ask questions about why certain clothes are available for children. Yes. You know, the sexual exploitation of children is something that I kind of, in a way, profit from. But
it's
we won't dwell on that
you.
Line far too quickly, because, you know, there'll be all sorts of accusations made. But actually, to defend my friend, she didn't ask whether or not I was dressed like a child. She asked me what I was wearing.
Right.
And she's absolutely brilliant and one of the best people. And I thought that was a really interesting even point to make because it wasn't something that I had considered. But yes, fashion. I was looking at photos of my kind of childhood over the weekend, and there was lots of photos of me and my sisters who are average height, and we were all dressed the same. And I've never really asked my mother if that was difficult when I was growing up. But I think because, you know, I probably, even though I was six, probably fit into age 2 to 3. I was slimmer than Alison, but we won't dwell on it. There was less of an ass. And again, we won't dwell on it. And I think coming up through my teens is probably...
I'll dwell on it.
Yeah. Coming up through my teens is probably when I became a little bit dissatisfied by my range of options, particularly because, again, I was the eldest and felt that I should have had more access than my siblings.
Yeah.
And yet my sisters had more access than I did. So, like, they would pick up high heels when they were 18 and fit into them, where that was never something that I experienced.
Yeah.
And I think that lack of kind of maturity and lack of feeling represented in kind of mature clothes was something that really upset me, probably, because I think for me, clothes is a vehicle to express my personality, because so much when I walk down the street, people make assumptions, as we were talking about earlier, about what it is and who I am based on my size. Whereas clothes gives me a way to change the narrative. And it's like, oh, she's a little person, but she's also wearing a ridiculous silver bomber jacket.
Amazing. Mm. Yeah.
I call it the mam repeller because my mother hates that jacket. And I bought it and she was like, you have nowhere to wear a silver tinfoil jacket. And I was like, I do.
I have
RuPaul's Drag Race Live. And she was like, that's the only place that you can wear that. So for me, fashion is a really interesting tool. But I also love the confidence that it gives people. You know, I wear clothes not to better myself, but to make me feel good on a particular morning or day. And they're also, you know, warmth. I think it's so interesting, you know, the conversations, how they differ as regards to fashion and sport. Sport is not my area of interest. I watch Wimbledon and that's about it. But, you know, we talk about sport in a way and we categorize it in a much different lens than we do fashion. We view fashion as facetious. We view it as something that's overtly feminine and overtly simplistic. And what
so bad.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's interesting for me is that we all wear clothes.
Yeah.
I go through most of my life not knowing about the Australian Open, and I only know that because of Twitter and what happened in the tennis, and yet every day we get up and we wear clothes. And not to quote like Meryl Streep in The Devil Wears Prada and talk about how cerulean went from Dior to pennies, but there's an ecosystem there that we all interact with, whether or not it is conscious or not. So for me, I think the conversation around fashion is really interesting. But yeah, I straddle the boundary of the two, and I have a brilliant seamstress who alters my clothes for me, and I really need to just learn how to sew. But I'm
You're like a Drag Race contestant.
Oh, I'd love to be a Drag Race. I would love to be Alyssa Edwards. She is my dream person. I would love to be Alyssa Edwards.
But I feel that like you can go two pathways being a teenager. Like when I because I was a fat teenager, yeah. And so a lot of stuff wouldn't fit me except like Gap hoodies or whatever. And I would just go, well, I'm just wearing this. I didn't follow fashion. And it's great that you're like a dog of a bone.
Yeah, I think because I've always been quite stubborn.
Yeah.
And I've always,
it's such
as well,
a great trait.
Well, I think because I followed my dad in many ways, that because when I was growing up, you know, some people ask me like, when did you realize? When did you find out? When did you discover that you were different? And for me, it was never about that. It was just realizing that.
You weren't different from your father.
Well, that's I was exactly the same as him. It was realizing that I might have to do things slightly different to my siblings.
Right.
And there was never, you know, this rationale that something was impossible. I just had to do things differently. So when it came to clothes, it was never like following fashion or having an interest in fashion was impossible. It was just that I had to do it differently than all of my friends.
Yeah.
And definitely there was times when I was really frustrated in, I had to learn very quickly that what I liked sometimes didn't suit me. So I would look at something with a drop waist. Yeah, and I had to learn that at age like 13 or 14 because I would look at something like that and realize, actually, my body shape doesn't work for that. And I remember being really dissatisfied by that. My mother telling me and being like, well, I just want to wear whatever it was.
Yeah.
And even to this day, I know what works with my frame. So I know, you know, an A-line dress, which comes in at the waistline because I have the same size waist as Kim Moss. And then flares at the hips because that's the bit that I need to hide.
Yeah.
Works for me. And it may not work for everybody else, but knowing that gives me confidence when I go in shopping. It was about that narrative of fashion and treating it as a business and understanding how the entire business worked, who the key players were, why two global conglomerates own most of the fashion brands in the world.
Why do they?
Money, Alison. Money. Money, 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 because they can. Salma Hayek's husband and family own one half, and then Kering owns the other. They are Kering, and then LVMH owns the other, and mostly Paris. So it's interesting how that all plays out. And then you look at like now and the political climate.
So it's like
climate.
A transfer market almost for football.
Exactly that, and designers change in between. So oh my god, look, we can have an offside rule and everything in Alfie. and you know, fashion is political. I at least believe it is. And looking at how the fashion industry is going to interpret what's happening politically at the moment is really interesting. So yeah, it started from that, and I think for me the changing point was the internet, because I would talk to my parents and my friends and my siblings at home about the various things that I'd learned or was interested in about fashion, and they're lovely, supportive, brilliant people, but they could not care less.
Yeah,
they actually, like, they genuinely could not care. Like, they like clothes, but they couldn't, they don't want to talk to me about, you know, the creative director of Chloe leaving.
Yeah.
They just don't care. So for me, the internet was a space in which I could share this view with either like-minded individuals or with absolutely nobody at all. But it was a way for me to get the information out of my head and away from my friends and family and leave them alone. And blogging was a huge vehicle for that.
How old were you when you started blogging?
My very first blog post was when I was in first year in college. So I trained to be a primary school teacher, and we had ICT lectures. And the idea for the assignment of the blog was to create a link between home and school. So we did a whole lecture on showing us how to set up a blog so that as teachers, we could post artwork or whatever it was on this blog so that parents in the evening could go home and look at it. And for the assignment...
Max, you got enough to be doing as a primary school teacher.
I know, you're not paid well enough to be doing that kind of thing. But with the assignment, the lecturer said you can write about anything you want to write about. It doesn't have to be education per se. So I wrote about Kate Blanchett wearing Givenchy Couture to the Oscars because I loved the dress that she wore, and submitted it as the assignment and, you know, passed or whatever. And then months later, when I was still kind of frustrated by the industry or was getting more engrossed into kind of the business and social media aspects to it, my parents got really sick of listening to me, and I remembered that that blog had been set up, and I just went back to it and started like writing bits and pieces. Like, the writing was awful, but it was a way in which to kind of distance those closest to me from all of that information.
And you started making a community then?
Yeah, I think so. It was a slow and steady progress, and for me it was about education for myself more than anybody else. It was about me finding a very legitimate and authentic way into the industry, into one that I didn't feel represented in. I didn't see anybody who looked like me either on a campaign, on a runway, or even those who were documenting the industry as regards to editors and journalists. So yeah, it was a catalyst. The internet was brilliant for me because it gave me an opportunity not to hide my height and my disability, but for a way in which it wasn't the most important thing about me. What right. was important was my critique, it was my interest, it was my rhetoric and my vocabulary. And yeah, that was really positive for me.
And I'm going to ask this before I forget.
Go for it.
The White House, if there was another event under this presidency, under Trump's presidency, would you go?
No. Yes. Absolutely not.
It wouldn't happen anyway, would it? Well, no.
I'm not on his list of priorities, considering the whole, you know, disability section is gone off the White House website.
That's
yeah, it's no. The principles and the values that I hold dear don't align in any way with what is being promoted within the White House at the moment. And you know, there was a pinnacle moment in his campaign prior to being elected in which it was the visible and you know, very explicit mocking of a disabled reporter. Now,
it's the grovelling.
Yeah, well, in my opinion, that wasn't the worst moment of the campaign. I think, you know, it's slightly ableist for people to talk about, gosh, if he could just, you know, mock somebody with a disability, what else would he do? And, you know, I think the conversation with him being in the bus and talking about grabbing women by the pussy and talking about, you know, ensuring that people who are Muslim can't enter the country. Not necessarily that it's worse, it's not a competition. But I think it's a very nuanced, awful debate that we must concentrate on, and there isn't just one thing. But no, I would say that I definitely wouldn't reply, even if Liz got on to me and said, why haven't you replied to the White House?
You'd be like, it's deleted, it's yeah. a virus.
it's gone, it's in my bin.
so about You're doing a master's now, aren't you?
PhD.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I have a higher diploma, so I've no idea what happens after that.
Me neither, Alison. Me neither.
But would you like to work in fashion now? What's the end game for you?
I don't know.
Because you should be president of Ireland.
Well,
that's
thank you. I'm
end
too
game
young
for you.
I'm too young.
I know
at the
it's
moment.
A disgrace that we should get
we
that
We voted
referendum.
For equality on one and not on the other. I know that's my. I marched to that beat too long. I don't know. Okay. I think when I was four, I remember going into my first day in junior infants, or I don't know if I remember this or somebody just tells me of my narcissism.
Oh, it's folklore of your childhood.
I think I was just always narcissistic.
I was a genius child, apparently.
Well, I can tell, Alison. I told everybody in my class that I was going to be a primary school teacher, and that's what I went and did. I had one choice in my CAO. And I think while many of my friends, excuse me, at 16 or 17 were kind of like, oh, what will I do with my life? I was very assured that education and teaching was where I was going to go. And then I graduated and I came out top of my class and it was brilliant. But I came out in the middle of the economic crisis.
Yeah.
And it was then when I was like, okay, I'm going to have to kind of shift positions here, because I was doing kind of one or two days subbing. And for me, I needed my classroom to be physically adapted. Like, you know, it was in the time of whiteboards, before interactive whiteboards, and principals had to make a decision about whether or not they would adapt a classroom physically for me for one day or just take a different teacher who didn't need those various adaptations. And it makes sense. So for me, I was kind of fighting this battle of whether or not this would be sustainable for me, whether or not I could keep up with all of this kind of chaos that was going on, and decided to retrain. So I went and did a master's in broadcasting because I loved the media's ability to tell stories and to highlight different voices. I was also disenfranchised and disappointed by the voices and the narratives which were told in the media, and would love to have the skills myself to do various things. So I did that. And then after that, I went and applied to do a PhD because, again, things hadn't picked up as regards to the economy and regards to jobs.
What
so
would you have liked to have done in media?
I don't know. I love documentary as a medium.
Yeah,
I love radio. I think radio is such a powerful tool for storytelling, as is podcast. I just think you can paint a picture with audio in a way that's much harder with television, as ironic as that sounds.
Yeah.
But I think what's important with radio, again, is conversation, is humour, is pauses.
Mm. And it's such, I feel anyway, it's such an intimate relationship between the person and
it's
the
listener.
It's
an audience of one.
Yeah, because even talking to you now, I realise that we're talking to other people.
That's it. And
I care about that as much.
Yeah. And I don't know, I'd like to do something like that, but I don't know in what shape or in what form.
Mm.
yeah, I'm really unsure. I'm very lucky that I have a couple of options at my disposal when eventually I emerge from the PhD, but I'm not sure. Something that will give me a 10% deposit for a mortgage is all I want. So whoever wants to hire me and give me that money and a pension, you have me.
Happy days.
Happy days. I know I'm starting to get old, but I'm like, oh, a mortgage, please.
I know that. I'm thinking about that as well, but I just can't see myself. I have to just look after the basics, sorting out my taxes.
All those fun things. But yeah, that's kind of, it's something that I didn't really, not necessarily worry about, but it wasn't even in my consciousness when I was like 21, 22. I'm 26 now. And decades ago. And it's definitely something I'm considering. I suppose I still live at home. And it's wonderful to live at home. My family are amazing. My parents are brilliant. But I would like to live somewhat more independently.
Yeah.
But with the rental market, you know, I have all of these challenges as regards to landlords and talking to landlords about adapting a property. Whether it's light switches or whether it's the lock on a hall door. And no landlord is really going to adapt a property to that extent for a 12-month lease.
Especially with the competition that's there.
Yeah, they don't need my money. They don't need my business. So really, I need to be in a financial position where I can buy or at least put a deposit down so that I can do those things myself. And
that's a disgrace. When
you're living with somebody, like, you know, they might be able to do the light switches for you or whatever it is, or open the hall door lock for you. But in an emergency, like if there's a fire and you're in the building on your own, like how do you get out? And perhaps there are properties out there that are much more accessible, but then will they be of a greater cost and all of those things? So yeah, that's what I would like a job for, so that I could have some independence, please, if you don't mind.
But with this, you're traveling a lot with covering fashion and stuff like that. I mean, do you see yourself kind of maybe supporting yourself with that, or
how's I don't know. So the organisation that I'm involved in,
you're doing it out of love.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant and it's amazing and it's all voluntary. And you know, perhaps there will come to a stage, you know, we're a startup where we will take kind of financial investment and, you know, shareholders and build it into a B Corp in the States. But it's hard to know, and it's hard to know the fashion industry's appetite to be challenged by something like diversity and inclusion and disability, and or if it'll still stick with the status quo. It'd be something I would love to do.
Yeah.
But again, me, I'm kind of, you know, 26 going on 45 and looking about, you know, what's the long term plan in this? And it's very much something that I want to be a part of for as long as possible. But I don't know. I'd love to work in fashion. But I don't know in what respect. I don't know whether it would be... I don't know. I would have to feel fulfilled by it. Fulfillment is a huge part of me. I want to be doing something that makes a difference. Not in a real facetious, egotistical way. There's a huge element of ego in it.
I do.
Yeah. I'd like the Nobel Peace Prize, if you don't mind. But getting something back from my work that isn't just money would be really important for me, whether that is mentoring other women or helping other disabled people or whatever it is. That would have to be a huge part of the work that I do. Yeah. Fingers crossed.
Because I heard you do a speech at the Waking the Feminists thing in the Abbey, and I just think you're so good at public speaking, and I feel there's a job for you. I don't know what it is yet, but like, I think in about 7 years' time, you're going to be a massive success.
Are you going to be my campaign manager?
No, I'm just going to hold on to this podcast and go, I talked to her. I knew her.
I knew her until I'm like disgraced in the front of a tabloid newspaper. You're like, we'll just take that off the internet there. So we
know. I didn't know her that well, actually.
No, actually.
I didn't know she was capable of
that. Yeah, it was a passing pad. We said hello on the street once and she completely hung out with me.
What podcast? No podcast.
I think with public speaking, I was probably... So my parents founded and run Little People of Ireland, the organisation here for little people. And when I was qualified as a teacher, it was an opportunity for me to go out and visit schools where little people were attending. Because even when I was going to school, there was people in my class who undoubtedly had questions about me being a little person, my family. And it's not really something you can ask, like, even among ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, as friendly as we are, we would find it difficult to kind of approach those questions and the stairs, or, you know, can you have a relationship? Can you become pregnant? Can you drive? Me visiting schools provides this wonderful opportunity.
I find people odd, though, that think straight about that. Like,
they're totally odd.
But there's a lot of them.
It was great. I was down in a school in Limerick last year, and I had first and second class, so they were like 7 and 8. And the teacher emailed me the night before and was like, they have lots of questions. And I was really flippant. And I was just like, oh, no, it's absolutely fine. In my head, I was thinking, I've done the late, late. Like, it'll be fine. The narcissism. And I went in and first class girl put up her hand. And I was like, yes, what's your question? She was like, what's your biggest regret in life?
No way.
How? I was like, oh, she was seven. I was like, oh, can you give me a second to think about that? I'm going to answer another question in the meantime. And I was like, yes, you. And she was like, what is your proudest accomplishment to date and what do you have left to achieve? And I was like, oh my God, I do not know the answers to any of these questions. I was like, just ask me if I can get pregnant. No. I was like, I have the answer ready for that one. I've been asked it enough. But no, like, kids are amazing. Yeah. Like, they just ask the most unexpected and surprising things that you really have to kind of... And it's not just about being little. It's about anything. And then the next question was, what's your favourite colour? And I was like, monochrome? Is that a colour? I don't know. Orange? I don't know. So kids are kind of brilliant. I don't know what my favourite colour is. And then I'm constantly... Like, I'm very... questioning of everything, and I'm like, oh, well, what does that say about me? And then it's like, doesn't matter, Sinead, it's a colour, like, you're grand.
What's the nicest thing you've ever worn?
The nicest thing I've ever worn? Ooh, good question. I have three capes that I own.
Capes!
I know, I love capes. Incredible. Far too many capes. But the outfit that I wore to the White House was pretty exceptional. So I had a week to go, and I met my friend. I was meeting my friend Colm, who's a wonderful stylist, Colm Corrigan. He worked on the Vogue shoot in County Kerry with Grace Coddington a few years ago, and he's the most amazing person. And we were meeting for lunch anyway, and I met him, and I was like, Colm, I'm going to the White House in a week. What will I wear? And we had this really interesting discussion about diversity in the Irish fashion industry, where we saw people represented, who we might be able to speak to about clothes or whatever. And in the end, what we did was we took inspiration from Leslie Jones from Ghostbusters.
Oh my gosh.
So prior to the Ghostbusters premiere, Leslie Jones couldn't get anybody to dress her. Nobody wanted to dress her for various reasons, but mostly because of her size. Wow. So she put out a tweet and said this, and Christian Siriano, the designer, kind of tweeted her back and said, I'd love to dress you, it would be an honour. And she wore Christian Siriano to the Ghostbusters
That's
premiere.
Disgusting.
Absolutely revolting. So we were sitting there having
Not
lunch.
That he offered.
No, no. We love Christian. Good man, Christian. But we sent out a tweet, and the tweet just said, speaking at an international event next week, does anybody have any... I have nothing to wear. Does anybody have any ideas? In the hope that somebody on Twitter would go, actually saw a skirt that would work for you, or an A-line dress that would work for you, or whatever it was, something that we had just missed or whatever on the high street or wherever. And 20 minutes later, I got a message from Moya Doherty, the co-founder of Riverdance.
Wow.
Who emailed me and said, I'm really sorry to hear that you're having this problem with clothes. Do me a favor, make an appointment with the Riverdance costume department. They'll make you whatever it is you want. It's on me.
Oh my God.
And I emailed her back and was like, what? What you're talking about. And kind of told her, you know, just so you know, like, it's for the White House. And she was like, of course it is. Have a wonderful time. And myself and Colm made appointments with the costume department in Riverdance. Over four appointments, we designed a top and a skirt. And yeah, 6 days later, I went off to New York with a new outfit that was custom designed by the Riverdance team. And to get to the White House and, you know, undoubtedly be asked, what are you wearing?
Yeah.
And to be able to say that a company like Riverdance dressed you. I mean, they have such images as to what Riverdance is, what it represents, and what it means to be Irish. And then to see it transferred into a beautiful royal blue satin skirt with a gorgeous cream blouse with a cutout sleeve and a V-neckline, which is quite unusual for me because children's wear often has a round neck.
Yeah.
So wearing a V-neck is unusual for me, and to be able to wear that and to be able to wear like jewellery from Irish brands such as Mo Muse and various places was pretty exceptional. And it was an incredible honour to go over there representing Ireland in that kind of way. And yeah, I just felt amazing.
That's incredible.
I felt deadly.
Yeah.
As they say.
I felt bleeding deadly.
Yeah. And I think, I'm quite, as regards to kind of clothes, what's the best thing that I have? I have a gorgeous yellow dress that a designer called James David Seaver made me. And I have little Stella McCartney children's shoes, yellow to match, from TK Maxx. I didn't pay Stella McCartney prices. And that's lovely, but I can't wear yellow that often. But I'm really kind of like jeans and a pair of runners.
Yeah, yeah.
A pair of shoes, because like footwear is my biggest difficulty because I'm a size 12 in a shoe.
Okay.
So finding shoes that fit, and often with runners, I'm only allowed to have like Velcro straps because that's what they won't believe children want.
Yes.
And whilst I say this to some of my friends and they're like, I would love sell crushed ups. I'm like, yeah. But you if say it's that all until your that's options. Your only option. Or light up runners, and they're like, I'd love a pair of Batman runners. And I'm like, no.
Yeah, it's like the way you go, I'd love some brioche.
Yeah.
Brioche every
all
day.
The time, you'd be sick of it. That's you exactly would. It. Well, I was teaching junior infants, and I got a new pair of shoes over the weekend, and I went in on the Monday to light up myself in my new shoes, and I was in the classroom maybe 20 minutes, and some girl put up her hand. She was like, I have them.
Oh my god.
I was like, oh, thanks. In the bin.
Double homework.
Yeah, so footwear is my biggest difficulty. I just want technology to evolve to a stage where 3D printing is available in households so that I can 3D print my own shoes.
That'd be yes, wow. That yeah. You thought about that. That's
I have thought intensely. I can't design for the sake of me, but that would be something that would be love to do. But I'm designing a scarf with a company called Electronic Sheep.
What?
The Irish company. So they're a brilliant knitwear company that make fabulous scarves.
Is this
so
the first thing you've designed? Or?
Yeah. I'll be like my friend James, David Siever, who's a brilliant designer. I've kind of, well, I would say I consulted with him, but he rightly should take most of the credit in that I'm like, oh yes, I like that colour. Oh yes, that's a nice shape. So yeah, we're working together on a scarf. So that'll be out for International Women's Day. And we're going to give some of the money to Women's Aid. And yeah, it's going to hopefully
some of the money to you.
Well, do you know what? I think it's a really great thing to be part of, and okay. I'm really honoured that like Electronic Sheep are trusting me to do this. And I think, yeah, if you can get
yeah,
back
sorry,
to
sorry, I wasn't.
No, no, no. They're paying me a fortune, Alison. No, no.
What's your mortgage? Yeah.
Long term. I'm so glad that you're rooting for me. You should be my bank manager. Be like, no, Sinead. Just text me once a week and be like, the mortgage, Sinead.
I'm totally rooting. Like, when I hear comedians do voiceovers on ads, I'm like, good on you.
Fair play to you. Charge the pants off them.
Get that money.
So it's exciting.
So I'm going to ask you about Alternative Miss Ireland.
Please do.
Because you're the last ever Alternative Miss Ireland. How does that feel?
Like, amazing. All of my narcissism and ego is rooted in that moment. No, it was incredible. I think for me...
And I should say, sorry, for listeners who are outside of Ireland, Alternative Miss Ireland is a class competition that's... how would I describe it?
It's a pageant-style kind of show, theatre production, that was predominantly for the LGBT community and was running in Ireland for 25 years. And it ended in 2012.
You did it better than I ever could. You were involved.
For me, I suppose it stemmed from going out as a college student in straight clubs. I'm straight myself, and going out in straight clubs and just like getting horrendously treated by random people in nightclubs. Like, there was an instance where, you know, I was dancing with friends and this random guy came up to me. He lifted me by the armpits into the air, went woo, put me back down and walked off. And then, you know, there was random moments where people would just behave horridly, like, you know, a group of young men stood in front of me and tried to unzip their fly in my face because of the banter, in inverted commas, of it all and how it made them look to their friends.
And that's just, I'm so angry for you.
And it was just awful. And I remember feeling really unsafe. And I remember feeling really angry by it all that, you know, I had paid into this venue like everybody else. I had the right to deserve respect and fair treatment from other people, and I wasn't annoying them. And yeah, it made me like not want to socialize in that capacity, which is very difficult when you're a college student.
Of course.
And then one night...
And you're from outside of Dublin.
Yeah, I am.
So this is your social... Oh, this
yeah,
is... Oh,
it was
gosh.
So awful. And
I'm
then,
so angry for you. Yeah. I'm so sorry.
And then I was really fortunate, like, that I had really good friends. And they kind of used to create this protective circle around me. And even now, I was out with my sisters and some friends over the weekend. And they do the same thing, that if anybody comes over and looks slightly creepy or weird or is trying to get close in an inappropriate way, they all kind of gather around me in this protective circle. And I always feel guilty about that because I'm thinking, well, if I wasn't here, you wouldn't have to do that and you wouldn't have to think about that. And I know friends and family don't think in that way, but it's something that I suppose internally bothers me. But I went to the George one night with those same college friends and we went to see Veda in the George. And we got there a little bit late and our table had gone. And I noticed that there was kind of disruption underneath the stairs of the George. And Veda and Davina had got stools out from underneath and actually put them in the like fire safety hazard space and called me over and gave us the stools because they knew I wouldn't have been able to see the show.
Oh.
And it was that kind of thoughtfulness. And we sat and we watched the show and we loved it. And then afterwards, everybody gets up on the stage and dances. And I remember feeling really insecure and thinking, if I get up here and dance now, will the same things happen again? And I kind of thought, well, there's no point in living in fear of. So I got up with my friends and we danced and I was left completely alone. Mm. And I was allowed to enjoy my night. And I remember kind of turning to my friends and being like, is this how it feels for you every Saturday night? Like, this is amazing. I totally get why you want to go out all the time. And that feeling of acceptance and welcome and being welcomed was just so incredible that when the opportunity for Alternative Miss Ireland came up, not that it was like a thank you to the LGBT community or anything like that, but I was just, I had felt so privileged to experience that in a way that I just really wanted to try it again. And the Alternative Miss Ireland was the most incredible platform to do that. And it was probably the best night of my life. Yeah, I got my family and my parents and all involved. They were on stage with me.
Oh my gosh. Mm.
Well, we retold the story. So you had to put together a performance for 7 minutes in length.
Yeah.
So we retold the story of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, but from my perspective. So I stood on a platform that was 4 foot high and had a Snow White skirt that was 7 foot in length. So I rang a contact that I had in Ardmore Studios and was like, hi, do you remember me? They were like, no. And I was like, I need a 4 foot platform for the Olympia Theatre, please. And most amazing people got involved to help. So Alan Stanford, the Shakespearean director, was based in the US at the time, and I emailed him and asked if he would record this narrative for me. This narration which said, once upon a time in a land far away lived a little girl who actually isn't gay, but why did she enter? I hear you all say, is she alternative? Why, yes, she was born this way. My seven tall dwarfs came out on stage. They ripped the skirt. They lifted me down, and we told the story of Snow White in 7 minutes. My mother came out to the Nina Simone's, I put a spell on you, dressed as the Wicked Queen.
Oh.
She gave me an apple and I died. And then the second half opened with me in a glass coffin, a real glass coffin. The guy who had done my windows in my house.
Did your coffin?
Did the coffin. Like, I rang him. He must have thought, this person, that's very strange. I rang him. I was like, hi, do you have any spare glass? And I remember rocking up to the Olympia Theatre that afternoon with a glass coffin and then being panicked, being like, if anybody falls on this, like, you know, there'll be chaos.
The production values are incredible.
Yeah. And I was in the coffin then, and the Snow White music started, and the seven dwarfs were around my coffin crying. And my dad came out dressed as Prince Charming to, and he kissed my hand. I woke up. He sang One Direction's What Makes You Beautiful. I sang Rihanna's We Found Love and changed the words to, instead of We Found Love in a Hopeless Place, to We Found Love on the Olympia stage. So we recorded all of the vocals in the recording studio in the Axis in Ballymun.
Yeah.
So we did all of that. We sang our own vocals and everything, and we ended it with the Black Eyed Peas' I Got a Feeling. A little bit cheesy, but it worked. And we choreographed it, and we rehearsed in where I went to college in Marino and Griffith Avenue. We brought all the dancers together a couple of times a week. And it was just the most amazing, fun project that I think if I had to do it now, I would have palpitations at the thoughts of the mass amount of work. But I kind of just took it in my stride and had brilliant people around me. It was the most amazing night. And I kind of didn't really tell that many people that I was doing it. So much so that when I walked up to the Olympia Theatre that afternoon for the get-in or whatever, a really good friend of mine was like, are you a backup dancer for somebody? Yeah. And I was like, no, I'm Minnie Melange. I'm kind of number six or whatever it is in the lineup. But it was the most amazing night. It really was. And I really can't thank like the Alternative Miss Ireland family, from Dolly, Dizzy, Panty, all of those brilliant people who put on that show, Niall Sweeney, Tony Walsh, all of those brilliant people who have really changed Irish society for the better in so many ways.
Oh, absolutely.
And given of their time and raised so much money. It was the most incredible night. I still have the crown.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It has like silver boobs on it and like hairspray and mirror fragments, and it's very delicate, but it's sitting, yeah, it's sitting in the attic and I still have it. And I think, yeah, it's one of those things that you come across every now and again and you're like, oh, I have my sash much closer to hand.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that's in my wardrobe and it sits there and reminds me every time I go through my wardrobe. I'm like, oh, yeah, do you remember that night?
That's incredible.
It was, yeah, it was extraordinary.
And did many opportunities come out of that?
A mix. I did a lot of kind of hosting quizzes and various other things for the LGBT community after it. I was on the George's float for Pride for a couple of years in the after it. And it was just amazing. I mean, the stage name that I used, Minnie Melange, became the name for the blog and became the name for like social media handles and all of that. So it was, yeah, it was something that I really wanted to hold on to. And I think using that name for the blog and various other things has been transformative in that way, but it was just one of the best nights. It really was, and yeah, it was incredible.
And so tell me about the blog anyway. You kind of started off for the primary school,
yeah,
but now it's like,
yeah, it's kind
it's
of
its
like
own entity.
Yeah, it's very strange. It's now like, I like to say that it's a platform for interesting conversations with interesting people. But obviously that's quite a biased tagline that overemphasizes things. For me,
I want that tagline.
Yeah, go for it. For me, it was about, I think because when I started the blog, you know, it was like that. It was a way in which for me to learn things and for me to document the things that I learned. And then I suppose as I begin to become more saturated within the industry and with information, I had all of these questions. Like, why does a designer do X? Why do they not do Y? How does this come about? And I realised that the questions that I had, or at least I felt at the time, weren't being answered in the places where I was reading. And kind of took it upon myself to email various designers and brands and people to be like, hi, this is me, you don't know me, but here's the thing I do. Could we meet for a cup of coffee?
Yeah.
And I was incredibly amazed by the amount of people who said yes. And, you know, I was walking down Georgia Street one day and I had bags everywhere. I'm like the bag lady. I carry bags in all parts of myself. And Paul Costello was standing outside Dunn's on Georgia Street admiring his work in the windows.
Yeah.
And I remember being like really like fangirling all over him. I was like, oh my God, there's Paul Costello. And I literally walked up to him. I tugged on the sleeve of his jacket. I'm sure he was like, what child is annoying me? And he turned around and I kind of stuck out my hand really boldly and was like, hi, I'm Sinead. It's really nice to meet you. I'm a really big fan of your work. I love what you do. I think it's incredible that we have an Irish designer of such presence and such notoriety based in London. It's really lovely to meet you. Enjoy your day. Like word vomited all over him.
Yeah.
And he was so kind. He was like, oh, it's lovely to meet you and do your work in fashion. And we had a really brief conversation. I went home that evening and on Bus Aaron's bus, I used their Wi-Fi and literally like guessed an email address for Paul Costello. Guessed it. I was like, hi, my name is Sinead. I have this blog. I'd love to interview Paul. I've just met him on the street. Please, can I talk to him? Like begging and pleading. And they got back to me and said that they were actually the shop. They weren't the studio, but this was the email for his assistant. Nice. Email his assistant and see how you get on. And his assistant is such a lovely man, Jordy. And I got on to Jordy and Jordy very kindly said, the next time Paul is in Dublin, we'll organise something. And I said, okay. And then he let me know that Paul was coming to Dublin and I met Paul in Dunn's headquarters. And he came down in the lift and I remember being a little bit nervous because I was thinking, does he remember me? How is this going to work out? Is there going to be judgments based on what I look like again? And sometimes doing interviews over email or phone is easier in that way because I'd never said in the emails previous, like, by the way. And yeah, I didn't want to either.
Yeah.
But the first thing he said when he came down the lift was, where can I sit that's comfortable for you? And he sat on the floor. Wow. And I stood so that we were at eye level. And we had this really interesting conversation for about an hour about the business of the fashion industry and what it was like to be Irish abroad and all of these other things. And I thanked him and went home and wrote up the transcription and sent it on to the team and said, you know, this is going out. Hope it's all right. Thanks a million for the opportunity. And they got back to me. They were delighted and said, and can we have your postal address? We'd love to invite you to Paul's show at London Fashion Week. And I've been at Paul's show and been invited to Paul's show every season since. And to see that that came from stopping him on the street, saying hello to him and him being kind, is really incredible. And then I have a series of interviews called Extraordinary Women, which was born out of a headline in the New York Times because it said that Mick Jagger's girlfriend had died. And the woman in question is Lorraine Scott, who was a fashion designer and died by suicide. And
oh, but she was Mick Jagger's girl.
Yeah. And we have quite a long hallway in our house and I was pacing it, like literally fuming with anger over the New York Times. And my sister, who's 2 years younger than me, Natasha, turned to me really flippantly, obviously annoyed at my anger.
Yeah.
And she was like, if you're so annoyed, like, do something about it. And as I said earlier, I'm very stubborn. I was like, okay, I will. And set up this interview series called Extraordinary Women, where I would not ask a woman about who it was they were married to, about a work-life balance, about their children, and about they were. And would never try to ask a sensationalist or overtly leading question that was kind of, you know, shrouded in a certain bias. And I think a lot of that stemmed from both the New York Times, but also my experiences of the media and being asked questions that were not nice, to say the very least, and very targeted. And I think for me, I just wanted to have a different kind of conversation with the women that I admired. And the whole idea was that it wouldn't be edited in any way. It would just be a transcription of the conversation. And then as regards to me, I would frame it with an opening paragraph and a closing conclusion and kind of links to where you could find them online or their work. And for me, it was the simplicity of that. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm a talker. So I was like, oh, this interview will take 10 minutes. And 3 hours later, you're like, oh, this is going to take me a full week to transcribe. But it was the most amazing avenue to meet such interesting people. So yeah, the blog is kind of still going and chipping away. It's difficult to update it as much as I would like to just with everything else going on, but I'm going to try to be more disciplined in 2017, Alison, and try to do it more.
Is that the plan then, to keep
that? Yeah, and to read more and to listen to more podcasts and to spend less time online.
Oh, I know. I have to read more too.
I got a watch for Christmas so that I will... Well, I asked Santa for a watch so that I would look at my phone less.
Yeah.
Because I check the time on my phone and then I'm like, oh, notifications.
Notification.
And 3 hours later, I'm like, well, that was a lovely deep dive into Instagram. I now know all of the things about, you know, teeth whitening and now know nothing about what it is I was supposed to be doing 3 hours later.
Do you feel like you could have a career through social media? Like, it seems like Ireland's a very small country. Yeah. I have no idea about it, but I feel that you would have a better idea about it.
I think there are brilliant, like as regards to like an influencer.
Yeah.
I think there are brilliant influencers here in Ireland.
Because you have such an interest and stuff, but I don't see you doing that.
For me, I think it goes back to the questions of as regards to like long-term plan. And yeah. I think it comes from my parents as well. And them always being very, so I'm the first person in my family to go to college. And my parents didn't go to college. They didn't have the opportunity to go to college. And for them, you know, we had conversations when I was younger about the importance of going to college and having a degree. Not because of any kind of notoriety or snobbishness, but for me, I always knew that, say, jobs, you know, being working at a cash register or working in retail would have been much more difficult physically for me. Mm. So I couldn't do those roles. Those roles weren't open to me. So I needed those qualifications in order to support myself, hopefully, and to have independence. And I think for me, as regards to that long-term plan, at the moment, I don't think the infrastructure is there.
Yeah.
But perhaps I could be very wrong. I don't think the infrastructure is there to support me as an influencer. And I don't think it's for me just yet. And I like being able to say the things that I want. And I like being able to not have to say anything at all. And I think when I like the freedom that the internet gives me and being able to read things from lots of kind of dissonant voices. And I think I would come to dislike it if it was my job and if I was depending on it to pay my bills and to go about my everyday life. I think I would not be as enamored by it.
Right.
And I don't want to go to that place either where I'm like, oh, I have to do this or I have to check my phone or, you know, and you have to reply to comments or all of those things. It's something that I really enjoy doing. So for me, not right now. Okay. But I think there's brilliant people doing amazing things. And
no, and I do too. Yeah. And I'm not slagging it
off. No, not
well.
At all.
And really not.
And I think they're doing great things. I just don't think I don't think it's going to give me the mortgage just yet, Alison.
I'm just trying to figure out a way.
Figure out a way. Yes. So how are we going to get mortgages? I think we just have to become president.
Why don't we just have a commune and we all...
Like the girls in Emma Klein's book last year.
I didn't read that. What was that? Tell me about that.
It was good. It was about the Manson case? It's kind of based on that. Okay. Gosh, Penguin will shoot me now because I'm saying that it's something that it isn't. It was kind of based on the various kind of different reports that happened. It was a really, really good book. I'm currently reading 4 books at once, which is very bold.
Oh,
and I'm kind
Mac.
Of being distracted because I'm not reading anything and reading everything. So I'm reading Zadie Smith's Swing Time. I'm reading Catherine Mayer's autobiography. So she was a publisher of the Washington Post, and yeah. I'm kind of a good portion through that. I'm also reading this brilliant young adult fiction where it's this teenage girl who actually has like a sort of amnesia of sorts, sort of memory loss. And the only way in which she remembers the things that she's done previously is about writing on her arm and kind of reminding herself these stories.
Oh.
But I've never seen disability portrayed like that within young adult fiction, within children's fiction. And then there's one other book that I'm reading. It's about like feminism and terrorism and like post-truth era, which is a heavier read, understandably. So I think I just need to sit down with a book and finish the book and then continue to the next ones.
Cool.
I think.
Right. I've asked a few people that. I'm going to ask you this one.
Oh.
What did you do for your English exam in your Leaving Cert? What essay did you do?
In my paper one?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Oh God, I can't remember. I can remember that I answered the literary genre question in the comparative study.
Let's hear it.
Oh, what were my texts? I can't remember. I had this fabulous English teacher. So I was terrible at English all the way up to junior cert. I got a C in my junior cert and honours. And I remember just not caring about English as a subject for my Leaving Cert because I kind of got it into my head that I wasn't good at it.
Right.
I had this amazing English teacher in fifth and sixth year. And I kind of told her, like, I'm rubbish. Like, don't even bother correcting my homework.
Oh.
She was like, what do you mean? You're great. And she taught me the importance of words and vocabulary rather than kind of sitting down and learning an essay or a poet, she taught me about like just language structure, which sounds really simplistic.
No.
But the beauty of English language, and gave me confidence. I got an A in English, which I wasn't expecting in my Leaving Cert.
You legend!
I know. My favourite poem from my English Leaving Cert course was Evan Boland's Pomegranate, which also happens to be my favourite fruit. So Ooh. Me and Colm O'Gorman would get along. Because he cooked pomegranate, MasterChef. I can't remember what my paper one essay was. It was probably nonsense. But I did the literary genre question. And I think I didn't even answer Boland. Who did I answer? Oh, I can't remember. It's ages ago now.
I'm just curious about what people wrote about when when they were teenagers.
I wrote a book when I was 12 called Phantom Heights, which was it was a write a book competition, which was in primary school. And I wrote this book. I probably wasn't 12. I was probably 9 or 10. It was called Phantom Heights. And it had this blue cover and it was about this. The teacher was called Mrs. Krakowski. And it was a school tour, and they went to Phantom Heights on the school tour, and they ate like frogs' legs and eyeballs. But I was most impressed by myself by the presentation of the book. So the book opened, and I had two ring binders on either side of the book, because of course you had to write it in those days. And there was like two flaps, but they were also the doors of Phantom Heights, and you opened it out. I think there's still a copy of it in the attic. So yeah, that's
along with your crown,
along with my crown and Phantom Heights when I was 10. I probably like it's probably an idea that I stole from somebody else, but the write a book comes. I don't think I've ever told anybody that story.
Good, I'm glad.
There you go.
To the bottom of it.
Yeah.
What about school tours? What was your favorite school tour?
I went to Dublin Zoo in Drew Infants, and there is a photo of me feeding the little chicks, and one of the chicks ran up the coat of my sleeve, and whilst everybody else was panicked, I was fine. I went to the Tawn Centre in Dundalk when I was in sixth class.
Tell me more about that. I've never heard of this place.
So it's in Carlingford.
Okay.
And we did all of the like team building activities, like banana boating, and
yeah.
And I remember
you gotta build a team in sixth class.
Absolutely.
You gotta.
And I remember they were kind of like, "Oh, will we get a wetsuit to fit her?" And I was like, "Yeah." I had no fear in those days. So everything, I was like, "Oh, up we go! Climb the walls, do all of the things." That was amazing. And we went to Paris for a day when I was in transition year.
Ooh.
And that was pretty cool. We kind of did all the touristy things. We left really early in the morning and we went for the day. That was great. No, we didn't go to Disneyland. We saw like the Louvre and we saw like the Arc de Triomphe and various different things. I didn't go on the 5th and 6th year school trip. That was the week long. That when I was in secondary school. I think the year, was it Barcelona my school went to? Maybe.
Mm.
And I was just like, nah. It was an awful shot.
I went to Lisbon on my school tour.
Did you enjoy Lisbon?
I loved Lisbon. We went to Fatima as well.
Ooh.
The it's like a Catholic Disneyland, so it is it's like
Knock.
Yeah, like Knock.
I love a trip to Knock.
I do because I'm a very lapsed Catholic, but I adore the iconography of Catholicism.
Yeah. Have you seen Aoife Kelleher's documentary about Knock?
No.
Oh my God, it's amazing. I went to the cinema to see it. So I used to be a first aider in my youth, and we would do an annual pilgrimage to Knock, and we would bring the elderly members of our community to Knock. But one of the younger cadets within the first aid organisation used to have to do the rosary on the bus, so she would use the bus driver's tannoy the rosary. And we used to have sandwiches underneath the bus, and we'd stop in Mullingar, which was halfway.
Aye.
And we'd have sandwiches from the bus in Mullingar, and we used to go to Knock every year, and we used to bring the various members of the community down to Knock.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it was mad.
What was the most disgusting thing you've ever done with first aid?
What was the most disgusting thing? Oh my God.
Did you like have to put entrails back? I don't know why I'm talking about
My siblings would be much more advanced in the first aid than I was. They kept it on after I left. I kind of went into a leadership role and like looked after the cadets because I am like the mommy of every group. And I really enjoyed that. Was it oxygen one year? I did one year, but I was up like I got to do the VIP section, so there was not chaos. I know I chanced my way in. And I think, it was more like burns and stuff. And it was just knowing. I think as well it really helped when I was going into teaching.
Yeah.
Just knowing various things.
Like if Coldplay got into a bit of an acid accident, you'd
Chris
be
Martin,
there.
I'm here.
Yeah. Let me rub that up.
Yeah. I don't think I'd do that for Chris Martin now. I think I'd leave Gwyneth to it despite their marriage difficulties. I'd just instruct somebody else how to do it.
She'd have a natural way.
She would. I don't know how I feel about Gwyneth. I'm kind of...
Yeah, actually.
I don't know how I feel. I dislike the level of criticism that goes her way. Now, some of it is deserved.
Yeah.
And, you know, linking healthy eating, and I'm not sure if she does this, but I know other people who kind of think in her way do, linking healthy eating or lack thereof to, like, disability and conditions is not good, and we should base things in science and we should base things in fact.
Yeah.
But I think the media's dislike and vehement dislike to Gwyneth Paltrow, we should be asking questions of. I think, but I don't read Goop, so perhaps my opinion is completely without fact. But yeah, I wonder why we hate her so much.
Because she's a woman.
We said that quietly. Where I'm very much like Team Rihanna in all things.
I love Rihanna.
I love. She gives no fucks about anything.
I didn't appreciate her property until Auntie came out.
It was an excellent album. I liked Rated R.
Oh, really?
And was it Loud that Man Down was on?
My problem was I worked in youth radio when Rihanna was at the top of her game, and you would have one song Rihanna and then one song featuring Rihanna.
Yes.
And then the next, you know.
She does a lot of features.
She does a lot of features. The woman is a hard worker. I didn't appreciate
that
before.
I just think the transition from Panda Replay to Auntie is incredible.
Ugh.
And she was tweeting about Trump the other day as well.
I just love that picture of her. Do you ever see the picture of her? She's just sitting on her bouncer's shoulder, bodyguard's shoulders.
No.
He's got a little shaved head.
Oh.
There's some powder on his head. And you're amazing.
We will ask no questions.
I love that woman.
I would do that.
If I had to do that, I'd do that.
I'm not on Snapchat anymore. And the one thing that
what happened with Snapchat?
I was going on and watching people's stories, and my content was not creative enough to be interesting. And I was going on and I was watching these kind of litany of stories, and it was time. And then it was like, I knew all of these things about people who I liked and respected and admired. And then when I got in front of them, I was like, oh my God, Alison, how was X, Y, and Z that you did yesterday?
Yeah.
And you were like, oh yeah, it was lovely. And I'm like, oh yeah, because I've already lived that experience with you. And I was meeting friends who I really loved and could already tell them all of their news. So I like the element of surprise, but I do miss Rihanna on Snapchat. I love the way she's still friends with like that small group of friends who she went to like school with and everything in Barbados, and they kind of, you know, they're her entourage. I just think she is amazing.
No, she is. She's properly.
And she's now like creative director of Puma.
Oh, she?
Yeah, so she's done Fenty by Puma. And she's done really pretty interesting things there. And FKA Twigs is now like a creative director for Nike.
That's incredible.
Which I'm very impressed by.
Is there any, and this is going to be one of the last questions.
Go for it.
Is there any celebrity collaborations with fashion that doesn't mean necessarily your opinion, but didn't really work?
So I think the H&M collaborations are always really interesting.
Yeah.
I think it's difficult to get something that is a luxury high-end brand, and when so much of the value of that is to do with the fabric and material, and then to bring it down to a high street level, I think is difficult. Because the prices are still more expensive than usually what you would pay in the high street, but nowhere near, say, what you would pay in a department store or whatever. And I think sometimes that transition is difficult to do. I do say that, and I queued for the Anna Della Russo and H&M collection. So she used to be the editor of Vogue Japan, and she's this like eccentric bananas person, and I bought these gold sunglasses that take up the entirety of my face.
Oh my God.
And they are so heavy that I cannot wear them, that they actually give me like a nosebleed after about 3 minutes. So they are purely decorative. I can't even put them on my head because they're so heavy.
Yeah.
And I wonder sometimes if that works, but maybe it's not about money, and maybe it's not about the visuals of something. Maybe it's about kind of like brand awareness instead, as regards to from a brand's perspective. So sometimes that I would have questions about, but if it's bringing democracy to a fashion world, to like the fashion world. So if typically the H&M consumer couldn't afford Kenzo or Versace or whoever the collaboration is with, and if H&M is a vehicle to do that, there's ethical questions there with regards to who's making the clothes geographically.
Yeah.
You know, labor laws and all of these different things that we need
there's
to ask.
So much about fashion that's problematic.
Like your faves are problematic. It's all problematic. But yeah, if it is democratizing it and giving a consumer access to a market that typically they wouldn't have, is that a good thing? Possibly.
Yeah.
But yeah, sometimes I would have questions about that. And then there's a brand at the moment called Vêtements, that's like kind of a Frenchish brand. They just showed at Paris Fashion Week, and they take like iconography and kind of make it in a high fashion way. So they've just done like a whole range of Juicy Couture tracksuits, where it's basically
basically
a replica of the Juicy Couture velour tracksuits with Juicy on the arse. And they
I
have
never
made
got
them.
To wear that.
Me neither. Well, maybe you can with Vêtements with like four times the price. And I have questions about the evolvement of that. I think as I'm getting older, I like I was in Marks and Spencer's the other day and saw a cashmere jumper that was €120, and I think 5 years ago or a year ago I would have been like, no, that's not for me. And now I'm like, warmth. comfort. Wouldn't that be lovely now?
Practicality.
Yes. So I'm all about the practicalities now. So yeah, I would have questions about that.
Oh, beautiful. Well, thank you so much for chatting to me.
Not at all. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no matter. I'm sorry if I shouted on about...
Well, listen, I reciprocated.
I know.
We got there. We could spend the day chatting.
I know, we could. We really could.
But we won't make we others won't. Listen to us. We'll take it off the air and discuss our father's heritage and see if we're related.
Exactly. I have to show you a picture of my dad.
Yes.
All right. I'll see you soon.
Bye.
Thank you very much for listening to the Alison Spittle Show. That was Sinead Burke. This is the outro, so I'm going to say goodbye to you. But first, before I say goodbye, the credits. Thank you very much to Sarah Garvey and Andrea Farrell team. Then Giles Brody and Dermot O'Brien, who helped do the first ever one. So thank you guys. Because I was sitting in the park and Giles Brody told me I should do a podcast. So, and then I go, no. And he goes, I'll organize the logistics of it for the first one. I was like, yeah, okay. So this is it now. And dear Brother O'Brien, who's just helped me all the time. No Monster Club, they make the fantastic theme tune. They wrote that in 4 minutes. When I say wrote that in 4 minutes, they used the song that they had before called Lava Lamp, and then they put my name in instead, which I can't thank them enough for doing, because I quite like it. And even though I listen to their original song, I still sing my name over the chorus, because I'm just that type of person. And then we have... William Conway, thank you very much to William Conway, guy I went to school with, who does my artwork now. Very happy. If you look at the artwork, there's details in it, like buttons for eyes. That's my brand. That's all. I have nothing of interest to tell you once again, guys, because this is back in the past. So, bye.
This has been a production of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.